This is the Creating Wealth Through Self-Storage show by Mark Helm. Nothing Mark shares with you guarantees your success in the self-storage business. This is for informational purposes only. There are no calls to action and nothing said or implied is a call for investment money into self-storage or any other asset class. You are responsible for your success in the self-storage business or any endeavor in life. Enjoy the show, and here is Mark Helm.
So let's talk about the development process for small self-storage investors in today's kind of world, with the higher interest rates, with the increased material costs and labor costs. My name is Mark Helm. I'm the author of Creating Wealth Through Self-Storage, and I create training for the small self-storage investor. You can find out more about what I offer at creatingwealththroughselfstorage.com. And one of the classes is how to build your first self-storage facility, covering most of the spaces we're going to talk about today. You can find out about it at that website. Hit the store button. But given that prices for existing self-storage are still high, cap rates are still around interest rate numbers, a lot of people are using development or expansions as a way to get in the self-storage business. But sometimes it's hard to make those even pencil out today. So last week we started the process that our construction company uses. We have a small self-storage construction company that's geared towards our products as well as kind of people in my world, and it's pretty much for the small self-storage investor that does kind of what we do. So we talked about the five phases that we move through bringing a project from concept to reality. Here are the five phases. We talked about the first two last week. Due diligence and planning and development phase, the development project approval phase, construction or construction one phase, which is what we'll talk about today, construction or construction two, which is administration and completion phase, and then setting up operations. We actually include that in our development process. So this week, we'll talk about the two construction phases. You can find out about phase one and phase two looking at episode 457. And next week, we'll talk about setting up operations and some of the bigger mistakes we see people making today. So let's talk about the construction phase, phase one of construction. So here's where we are. We have development approval. I'm not going to rehash last week, but with development approval, there's still some work to do. We don't usually have our building plans approved, and very often we don't have a complete set of site work drawings from the civil engineer. We do that. We get as much done as we need to get the approval, simply to keep our costs down. I'm going to show you the spaces that we cover in this construction phase. Biddable construction plans, value engineering, review of final plans, number, schedule is created, and then get the site disturbance and the building plan permit. So here's where we turn the architect loose. At this stage of the game, we have engineered drawings of the building from the fabricator. We have a site plan, which has probably been enhanced a little bit by the architect in order to get the project approval. And at this point, we give that CAD to the architect. And keep in mind, we use an architect that is very knowledgeable about self-storage. That's all they focus on. They do it nationwide. And we basically engage them on an hourly basis. And at this point, we turn them loose to take the CAD from the fabricator and create plans that can get stamped and approved at the county or city regulatory level wherever we're doing the project. If the engineer did not complete a full set of site drawings, which we won't do unless we have to do it to get development approval, we turn them loose to do that too. Yes, going this route takes a little longer to get a shovel in the ground, but given the cost of construction today, I'm willing to trade time for money. Now, I wasn't always willing to do that. When interest rates were 4% and it cost me $45 to $50 a square foot to build a facility, very often I would trade money for time so I could get into the market sooner. Not the case for us today. We'll go a little slower so we can keep our development costs down. On larger properties, if I'm doing 50,000 square feet or so, very often we also turn the architect loose to do the MEPs, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing, HVAC, electrical, and plumbing. If we're doing a smaller project, very often we don't get a full set of MEPs. What we'll do is we'll get bids from contractors and we ask them to recommend to us what they would do and the scope of work they would do. And then we take those bids, run it by our engineers and architects, pick which one we like the best. Then we go with that set of plans on the scope of the work for the HVAC, for example. And then we have the contractors rebid it. Again, takes a little longer, but keeps our costs down. If we're doing a larger project, we just go on and get the architect, who usually has to engage an outside engineer to spec the MEPs. Then we have, at this stage, when the architect's done, we have literally plans that we can now send out to bid, which we often do at that point. In the next phase, what we do is we sit down with the architect, the engineer, us as the contractor. If we're doing this work for clients, we have the clients there, and sometimes some of the subs that we already know that we're going to use or we've gotten bids from that we like. And at that point, we look over the project and figure out where we can value engineer or change the scope of the work a little bit in order to reduce the cost. Our game here is not to reduce the value of the project, certainly not do anything that would affect the rental rates that we can do, but where can we cut cost in the building? Very often we find savings in HVAC, for example, where we can change we've changed the amount of ductwork necessary. Altering finish items, altering scope of work that we're going to do in the restrooms. I have one client, after getting bids, site work contractors indicated that you didn't quite need the slope that was in the plans for the civil, that you could cut that slope down by a percent and it would still, water would still surface drain and work fine. We went back to the civil agreed, county quickly approved it, and he saved $100,000 on site work costs right there. So there's a lot of ways you can value engineer a project. Again, game not to change the quality of the project. Then at that point, we get any rebids we need to get from subcontractors. We look at the final numbers, enter those numbers in the pro forma, and the client or we have to make a decision. It's a go, no go based on those numbers. Last week we talked about knowing what your benchmark numbers are, and now at this stage we know what it's going to cost to get those benchmark numbers. Do you hit them or not? Then we immediately, or the engineer immediately, goes and up gets the site disturbance permit and or the building plans, and then we can start construction. So if we're working with a client, at this point the client has our bid, and we encourage that client to go out and get other bids, because as soon as you have the biddable plans, that you can get multiple bids. In the world of transparency, which is one of our key values, we use it on everything we do, we want that client to know where our bid stacks up in relationship to other contractors. So we always encourage people to get multiple bids. If you're doing the process yourself, where you're overseeing and you're functioning as a construction manager or the GC, sometimes it's still good to get a bid to see what it would cost to have a general contractor do it, and then compare it to the costs you have from the subs that you've got, that we've helped you get the bids from. Now we're ready to move into the next phase of construction, what we call a construction administration through and completion. Here are the spaces we're going to cover in this section of the development process for the small self-storage investor. Construction management, deferred submittals, optimizing unit numbers, walkthrough, or you could say walkthrough punch list, and certificate of occupancy. If you're doing this process yourself and you're functioning as the GC or the construction manager, just dealing directly with all the subs, you've got to create some kind of way to do some construction management. There's scheduling of the subs, there's making sure that they show up, there's being on site to answer questions. One of the key things you don't want happening is to have nobody there. Subs are out working, subs are blowing and going, and they need a question answered. If there's no one there and they can't get anyone, typically they'll make decisions in the field. And my experience is you don't want subs making decisions in the field. Typically, they will do what's best for them, and that's not always, or I will assert even rarely, what's good for the project. So I like, you've got to figure a way to be there or be there at a known time each day and be able to answer questions and oversee what's happening and make sure that the work that's on the schedule to be completed has people there doing that work. Now, if you're dealing with a GC, that's one of the questions to ask them. How will they handle construction management? Just make sure on-site supervision is covered in an efficient and predictable way. Now, there will be things that need to be approved. We're calling those deferred submittals. There will be things that show up that need to be approved that aren't necessarily approved when you get your building permit. Now, these deferred submittals can slow down. We've had them even stop projects. So you've got to have another reason for having good on-site management. You got to have a way to deal effectively with these issues. Examples can be signage, gates, ADA requirements. These are items that need regulatory approval. They come up during the construction phase and during inspection phases from building inspectors. I'll give you one story, for example. In our plans, we always make sure we have ADA units, the number required on a national level. I can't remember off the top of my head what that is, but we make sure they're incorporated in our plans from the fabricator. And there's industry standards on what comprises an ADA unit. And usually if it's like outside drive-up storage, there's a slope in the concrete, it doesn't have that 2-inch lip that you usually see. And even in climate controlled buildings, the doors tend to have lower latches and then they usually have straps on them. So there's a kit you can buy to alter a door to make it ADA compliant, and we do that on the designated ADA units. And during the building inspection on a project we had in South Carolina, for example, for whatever reason, the building inspector said for these ADA units, they wanted door openers. In other words, like a garage door. So a roll-up door wouldn't work. You had to get a door, section door, and they wanted us to put openers on these ADA units. Now, typically what we would do is we would go back to the county and get a, you know, I don't want to say fight that, but argue that and get a waiver or a conditional use to avoid that. But given where we were in the construction of the project, we didn't want to waste the time and energy to do it. And after talking with the county and talking with the engineer, it was doubtful or questionable whether we would be able to actually get that waiver. So we decided to just go on and put the doors in and the door openers on. So, but those are examples of some of the deferred submittals that will happen during the construction phase. And you've got to be able to quickly deal with them or be shut down or slowed down or not be able to at least do that work. And we even include in our development process optimizing the unit numbers. Now, that might sound silly, But believe me, I've made all kinds of mistakes laying out how we identify the buildings and identify the units. The game here is, especially as we move more and more towards less employees and more remote management, the game here is to make it easy for the client, the customer, to be able to identify where their unit is and to be able to get to it. Sometimes the customer will go to their unit once, load it up, and it might be 6 months or a year, some cases, before they're back there. And they can't remember where that unit is. Also, we try to design it so it's very fast and efficient for whoever's doing the walkthrough unit reports that we do at least weekly. So there's an art to this, how you lay and identify the units in the buildings, and it's got to make logical sense. And we spend a lot of time on this, and we spend a lot of time working with clients on this. Then what we typically do as we get towards the end of the construction is, once we think the project is substantially complete, we will do a walkthrough with the owner or with ourselves. Now, in our construction contracts, we hold back 10% of our fee on every draw, and that's retainage. And then we will do a walkthrough, create a punch list. And once that punch list is completed and everyone signed off on it, the retainage is released to us. Now, if you're doing this yourself, it's going to be hard to get 10% retainage from your subs on every draw. Very often these subs are living week to week and they've got to pay the people, but we advise to at least get 10% retainage on the last draw. That's typically what we did when we were managing our own projects. And we get 10% retainage on the last draw, do a walkthrough with that subcontractor, make sure that the work is complete, create a punch list, and then once that punch list is done, we will release the remaining retainage for that particular subcontractor. Then we apply for the certificate of occupancy, CO. Sometimes, if we're doing multiple projects, or even if we're doing a single building and we're not complete with construction, as long as the what remaining construction is not impeding customers entering the facility and or entering a building, we will request a temporary CO so that we can go on and get started leasing while we complete the construction phase. I guess we do that on 30-35% of our projects and get a temporary CO where we can start leasing before 100% of the construction is done. Again, you just want to make sure it's safe for the customer and they're not going to be really running into each other and be in each other's way. Most counties will grant that if they can verify that what you're saying is correct. So my goal here is to outline kind of the process that we're using and most of the savings that we're able to bring to the table as a construction company and doing our own projects are in the first two phases that we talked about last week. However, there can be substantial savings if you manage these two construction spaces of development efficiently and correctly. So I hope this helps you today and gives you some confidence to really look at perhaps doing a development ground up, definitely do expansions. And this process even works, although it'll be altered a little bit more on conversions, like there's no site work usually on conversions. But these are the spaces we go through. Next week, we'll talk about setting up operations, and we will talk about some of the bigger mistakes that we see people making today who are doing development, usually 50, 60,000 square feet or less. So thank you very much. I look forward to being with you next week. My name's Mark Helm, and one of the tools that we use to analyze the cash flow and the potential profitability of a project is the Storage World Analyzer. You can find out more about it at storageworldanalyzer.com or creatingwealththroughselfstorage.com. Click the Storage World Analyzer tab. Thank you, and I look forward to being with you next week.